Anybody comes in late, they'll just miss an introduction. This is the first of two sessions. My name is Glenn Myers. I'm going to be talking about estimating loss costs at the address level. And then Serhat Garvin will be talking about driver averaging by policy, if I understand what you're doing. Okay. So I'll just go ahead and start. We're going to be really talking about, you know, what used to be called territorial rate making. Now, one of the things we learn when we do territorial rate making is that territory should be big enough to have a sufficient volume to have be basically credible. At the same time, right here, we know that territory should also be small. You all know the local conditions around you. There are bad corners. There are all kinds of other things that are going around. There are a lot of business districts and stuff like that. And that there's, you know, when you have a big enough territory to be credible, you're going to still find that driving conditions vary significantly within that territory. Now, to give you an idea, some of the things we look at right there would be proximity to business districts. Workplaces, you know, when, you know, basically quitting time comes, everybody is out trying to get there on the road. They may go to shopping centers, which are probably always busy except for the middle of the night. And then restaurants, they're busy at mealtimes. Schools, especially high schools, they're busy right around the time that school lets out. So there's a lot of traffic going on, and these are the kind of things that can cause accidents. Other things that can cause accidents is weather. You have rainfall, temperature, freezing temperatures, snowfall, freezing temperatures in hilly areas, stuff like that can also be a good cause of accidents. Traffic density, what we've got right here, what it really boils down to is that the more traffic sharing the same space increases the odds of an accident. And there's a whole bunch of others. Now, individually, you can spot all these geographic and demographic type variables that will have an effect on accident rate and also accident severity. But they come in different combinations. And they have a combination of positive and negative effects. And so essentially, what we are doing at ISO is we are building a model that calculates the combined effect of all these variables. Okay, and it's going to be based on countrywide data. In other words, being close to a shopping center in California is probably pretty much the same as being close to a shopping center in Illinois or any place else. Now, there's other things going on in California that's different from Illinois, and we want to basically build a predictive model that takes this all into effect. Now, I'm going to start off just basically saying what the final model is giving us right here. We're actually going to make a loss cost, which is going to be a pure premium for a very specific standard risk. Okay? Now, essentially, it's going to be a frequency times a severity, where the frequency is going to be what we call a logit function. Okay? And essentially, the linear predictor is going to be an intercept plus a component which we call weather, traffic density, traffic generators, traffic composition, and what we call experience and trend. Now, you should mention right here that what we mean by frequency right here is the probability of having one or more accidents. And you will see that the expression for frequency will basically go between 0 and 1. Now, when we do the same thing for severity right there, we of course mean this is going to be the severity when you have one or more accidents. And here, instead of using a logit transform, we use the exponential or the log link function, as you would say in GLM. And we also basically make these the linear part of it. It's going to be a combination of the same kind of variables. Okay, now, what we do when we do this is that we actually build separate models by coverage. Is one for bodily injury, property damage, collision, comprehensive, and no fault. Now, the way we do this is we actually construct a fairly complicated model, and I'll get into that, but it contains more variables than are just simply the ones that we assign names to. And what we did is we grouped the variables. And so the first, what we call N1 of these things, are things that we think are related to weather. The next N, going up to the next N2 variables, okay, we call these variables will be called traffic density. Then we have another set of variables that we group together and we call traffic generators, traffic composition, and experience and trend. And also in building the model, we take into account the other classifiers as well. But the other classifiers, what they do is they reflect driver, vehicle, limits, and various deductibles. But when we deploy it, what we do is we deploy it to the standard risk, which is somebody driving a 2006, what we call symbol 8 vehicle. The driver itself is a 30-year-old, no multi-car discount. So when we deploy the model, we deploy it to that particular kind of driver. And so that's what our loss cost gets to be. And then when you want to apply it to another one, you can apply the driver and vehicle factors and so on to get your final rate. So in other words, what this is, it's going to be an address-specific version of the ISO loss cost. Okay, the data used in building the model, first of all, what we did is we contacted a number of leading insurers, and what we did is we said that, okay, we want basically address-specific data from you, okay, and in return, we will give you an advanced peek at the model, and we have been doing this all along. Okay, and so there are some leading insurers out there who have advance notice as to what this thing is going to be about. Okay, we also have a variety of third-party data. Consists of traffic patterns, business locations, demographics, weather, and a lot of other things we looked at least going in to building this model. And what we have in our final model, we actually ended up with something about approximately 1,000 different indicators that we actually pull together into variables into ways that I'll describe. Okay, the weather variables, what that consisted of right there is measurements from about 15,000 weather stations scattered throughout the U.S. There you get measures of various snowfall, rainfall, temperature, wind, and elevation. Okay, the other one, say for example, the traffic density, we take a look at various commuting patterns, public transportation usage, population density, and so on. And the traffic composition, traffic generators, take these kind of things into account, traffic generators as shopping centers, hospitals, entertainment areas, and so forth. Now, the experience and trend, really what that boils down to is the ISO loss cost supplemented by state frequency and severity trends that we use in our regular loss cost analysis. Now, the modeling techniques we employ, first of all, in variable selections. What we do is we will look at these things pretty much one at a time, use maybe there's going to be some kind of transformation that's necessary to sort of pull this all together to make it look like a linear variable. We make ample use of sampling. Now, the other thing we do right there is various data reduction techniques. This would include things like principal components. That's one of our big methods. We also use neural nets to combine a whole bunch of data, a whole bunch of variables into a single variable. And I'll give some examples of that as we go on. And also, especially for things like the weather, we use a certain amount of spatial smoothing. In areas where we expected things to move gradually and the data was recorded in a non-gradual way, we would actually go about and do some smoothing of the variables. Now, here's a fairly complicated diagram right here, and let me sort of explain how we do this sort of thing. Say, for example, I'm going to take a look at our weather component. Okay? Now, we start off with the raw data going at the bottom here, 35 years of weather data from our weather stations. And then we basically construct a bunch of weather summary variables. This includes, like, okay, how often is it below, how many days of the year on average is it below freezing? What's the average snowfall? Stuff like that. And then we summarize these variables, and then we put these things into what we call a temperature model. Okay, now the temperature model was sort of taken, we took those summary variables and plugged it into a principal component analysis, because a lot of these things are correlated. Freezing and snowfall tend to be correlated and stuff like that. So we actually came up with, did a principal components analysis to combine this into a small number of variables. Now, like we did this for the weather severity scale, also came out of a principal components analysis, when you do a principal components analysis, you'll find that there are a bunch of different components that come out that have different variables in them that are weighted in different ways. Now, the weather neural nets that are on either side of this analysis, we actually threw together not only our weather station data, but we also threw in data we had on elevation and variance of elevation. Snow may be okay on a flat surface. It is not terribly good on a hilly surface for accidents. And we actually built models that tried to predict claim frequency from these weather, from these neural nets. Now, the software we had actually would kick out a variety of neural net models depending upon the architecture of the multi-layer perceptron. And then what we ended up right there is selecting two of these models as input into our weather variable. So what we have right there is, in this case, for the weather, that is going to be a combination of five subvariables that go into our model. Now, underneath all these other big blue, dark blue boxes we have here is a very similar type of, subvariables that sort of go into it. We did this same kind of analysis for each one of the other boxes that are here. Now, this is what feeds into the frequency model. Then we also have a similar thing for the severity model. Now, that, when we multiply the frequency and severity, that turns out to be our coverage loss cost. So that is the way we did this. Quick question? Well, we actually did some smoothing. Okay, it was actually smoothed. It was actually smoothed over, and it had to do with how far the distances, the weather stations were separated. Okay, now what I want to do is I want to get into some overall diagnostics of the model. Now, I'll point out right here that these results are preliminary. We keep finding all kinds of funny little things, a way we can do to improve the model. The most recent improvement was made actually on Tuesday. Okay, and we want people to check this over, but, it was a good thing we did that because we got more lift when we did it, and I'll explain that. Okay, now, one of the ways we do this for the overall model diagnostics is that we sort in order of increasing prediction. We do this separately for frequency and severity. And then what we do is we group the observations into buckets. We have, in this case, several hundred thousand records at this point. And so what we do is we take 1/100th of the record count into each of these buckets. And for the severity, they're a little more volatile, and so we took 1/50th of the record count for the severity model. And then what we did is we calculated average bucket frequency and severities. Okay, then what we did right there is we transformed these severities and frequencies into the space of the linear predictor we used for the GLM. Okay, and then what we do is we plot the predicted linear predictors against the empirical linear predictors. And we also put confidence intervals on this. And so this is the first one right here, which we did for frequency. Now, in other words, what we have here is we have the predicted logit that came from our model and the empirical logit. And as you can see right there, this runs very nicely, okay, along, you know, the diagonal line. We have the red line there, which is what it would be if they were equal. And we can see that the red line goes very nicely through most of the confidence intervals. This is out of sample, okay? Now, here is the one we did for the severity as well. And so what we're seeing right there is we're actually getting, first of all, there is a difference in the predicted frequency and severity, but also it seems to fit pretty well, okay, the linear, the linear structure that we've put on it. Okay, now, what next thing I want to do right here is I want to come up with diagnoses of the components. Now, what we do is we have these components. You'll recall one of them's weather, one of them's traffic density, one of them's traffic generators, another one's experience and trend and so forth. And so what we did right there was we wanted to take a look. Okay, do these components behave as we would expect them to? So what we do is we actually, again, we separate these things into buckets before. We sort them in order of a particular component. And then what we do is within each of these buckets, we calculate the average probability of having a claim in each bucket. And now what happens is that we also calculate something we call the, and of course, the first thing they wanted to see was, do these things make sense? Okay? And they wanted to look at maps. Now, ISO is located in Jersey City, and Jersey City is, right around, I probably could have put a circle, but right around a little bit south of Hoboken here. So we're right in this area. But, you know, we have people that live around there. Now, the dark black lines you see are the various territories, okay, that you see. We've got Newark, New Jersey in there. In Newark, New Jersey, this area, you've got, you know, a lot of inner city Newark type areas. But as you get out, you've actually got some fairly nice suburban areas. Okay, now as you take a look right here, the green areas right there are the areas with the highest relativities, and okay, the white areas are the places are the areas with the lowest relativities. And say for example, if you take a look, and you can see that within Newark itself, there definitely are dark areas and light areas, and as you go to Elizabeth, you get into some of these right here. We've got, Westfield down here. This is an area where some of our vice presidents live. And so we noticed that. And that's, of course, that's a little heavier. But as you get out into the more suburban areas, you can see that, yes, okay, there are, we're actually predicting, okay, differences within territories. So there is quite a bit of heterogeneity within territories. Okay, now, that's fine. Yeah?
Now, we're going to get down to the individual address level. So are those grouped by city or zip code?
The resolution of our maps are down at the census block group level.
Okay.
Okay. And we don't expect much change, things that are close together tend to be close together in loss costs. You know, this isn't a, you're not going to see your next door neighbor getting half of what you're getting. Okay. Now, the other thing right there is, okay, so far what we've done is we said, okay, we have differences, but do these differences track with losses? Now, we've been discussing this with an awful lot of non-actuaries, and I first started off right here going with things like a Gini index. I actually talked about the Gini index last year at the predictive modeling seminar. And, you know, and we talk to some of the people who are not actuaries, I get a bunch of blank stares with a Gini index. Okay? And so what we've been doing is that I'm still playing around with the right kind of statistic that really means something. And so what you're going to get is the latest version of this, you know, of how we demonstrate lift. Now, first of all, right here, you want to, say, demonstrate the ability to select what we call the more profitable risks, okay, if you were to use this as an underwriting tool. You also want to demonstrate the adverse effect of competitors skimming the queen against you, adverse selection. Okay, will this happen? And then we came up with a new thing that we think we made up, but at the same time, never claim originality for anything because somebody always has done something like it. Then once the insurers, okay, see, you know, what you can do right there by this skimming the cream or risk selection, they may decide to take other actions, say, for example, like actually write price. Okay, so what we have here is this is the effect right there of selecting lower relativities. In other words, what we want right here is we want to say, okay, I'm going to basically get all the guys out who have, you know, relativities by our model greater than, say, 1.2. We can do it for greater than 1.1. And actually what we did right there was here we've selected out we took out the worst 5% of the relativities, and we can see that that lowered our loss ratio by about 0.5%. If we go all the way here and select the get rid of the worst 25% of the locations, we can see we're going to lower our loss ratio by a little over 3%. This is for BI. Okay, as we go to PD, we get about 2%. If we go to comp and we knock out 25% of the loss ratios of the risk, okay, of the premium, we can see that, gee, in this case, for comp, we're going to be lowering our loss ratio by about as much as 9%. Okay, so there is real gains to be made by risk selection. Okay, now the one thing, the kind of feedback we get from, you know, people on this is, no, wait a minute, I don't want to cut out 25% of my business. Okay, so, well, then, you know, that's not, you know, we just don't want to cut down on our production. Well, so let's look at it this way. Let's suppose that the competitors come about right here and starts basically selecting against you. What you do is your competitors take away 10%, the best 10% of the relativities. Here you can see that your loss ratio will go up right here. It looks like about 0.5%. But if they take away, okay, the top 50%, okay, of your premium by skimming the cream, the guys with the lowest relativities, you can see that your loss ratio for BI is going to go up by about 6%. Okay, and these percentages vary. Comp, you know, it turns out to be right here that if the competitors sort of skim the cream, you know, take away the best relativities, we can see here that, you know, the loss ratio of those things that are remaining right here will go up as much as 10%. Okay, so these are, there's real, again, territory differences here. Okay, now somebody says, okay, what we can do right there is we can do this territory system right here, and essentially what we're going to get, okay, from this is that everybody will be right price, we'll be still making the same loss ratio we were before. Why should I do this? Well, that sort of, these kind of discussions led to something which we call the value of lift. Now let me explain a little bit about what this means. Let's assume a competitor comes in and takes away all the business that is less than your territory average. And because of adverse selection, the new ratio will be higher than the old loss ratio. And the question right here is, what is the value of avoiding this fate? And I want to express this right here as the difference being proportional to the difference between the new loss ratio when the competitors have come away and, you know, taken away all the good guys, and the current loss rate. And I want to express this thing called the value of lift, okay, in terms of a dollar car value, a dollar per car year. Okay, so we set this up right here. LC is current losses. We have the current loss cost. Okay, we have the new losses for the business that are remaining after the adverse selection, new premium, and then we also have the current exposures. Now, what we have is this formula for the value lift, which is the loss ratio right here before the loss ratio after the adverse selection minus the loss ratio that was before it. And then what we do is we translate that into dollars and divide by the total car years. So the numerator represents the dollar value of the loss that comes from competitors skimming the cream. And dividing this expresses it as a value per car year. Okay? Now, we actually calculated that for the existing business. And so what we get here is the value of Lyft right there is about $5 per car for BI. And as you go all the way down here, we can see that this is going to be about $12.50 per car year. So in other words, you should, this is an ideal statistic, okay? And it assumes that people are going to hop away because of price rather than service and all these other things. But it makes sort of a commodity assumption. Now, in reality, adverse selection won't be that bad for you. But the idea right here is this gives you some idea as to some sort of ballpark estimate, as to how much, this classification is worth. And even our sales guys are understanding this, okay? So the idea, of course, the cost of this would be considerably less than that, but the idea that gives you some idea as to what this is worth. Okay. Next thing right there, okay, a theme I have heard pretty consistently through this is that to basically do multivariate analyses with a lot of data, with a lot of different variables, you need a lot of data, okay? We did this with a combined database from several companies, okay? Now, what we want to do right there is we condensed these variables. We started off with about 1,000 and then we condensed it into 5 variables. Okay? Now, so what we've done in condensing this to a lower number of variables, we made it possible to take advantage of this analysis and again allow companies to customize it. Now, so what we did here, and what we did for the frequency model is, I think, fairly typical. What we do is we supply the weather component, traffic density, traffic generators, and so on components. And then, for the ISO model, the way we set them up when we rigged it, okay, is that those coefficients are going to be 1, just simply by design. Now, companies may want to use these variables and use some coefficient other than 1 by fitting this to their own data. So what we've done is that we have summarized the variable that allow for actually quite flexible, customization. Okay, now, one thing right there is when you get to customization, in doing this, we found that there were a couple of things we had to deviate from the standard general linear model practice. Now, first thing we did right there was that, first of all, like in BI, you're going to find out that maybe it's in the neighborhood of 1% of the records have losses. And folklore, got from data mining, you sort of like to have an equal number of loss records and no loss records. Actually, I don't think we're quite there, but we did involve a sampling scheme. So we only took a subset of the losses with other records with no losses. Another problem you have right there, if we are seeking to find the probability of having a loss in a year, you'll find out that there's some records have losses, have a policy term of a full year. Some losses have most common thing is policies having terms that are 6 months. Okay? And you take a look right there due to cancellations and so forth, there's any number of fractional year any number of fractional year exposure periods, okay? And, you know, the probability of having a loss will depend upon how long the car is in effect. So what we needed to do right there is we needed to account for, okay, the sampling and the exposure in building the model. Okay, and how do we do this? And I think we're going to have to dig into a little bit of math here. But it's actually it's an interesting little debate we had in coming up with this. We start off, we want to basically calculate the annual probability, given that we know if the thing had a claim, if there was, you know, the policy term and a sample rate. And if you were to write down right there, if you know the annual probability, you can actually write down the probability of a claim, given that we have a partial year and a certain sample procedure. Okay, and it turns out that you can actually, since you can get that probability, you can calculate the likelihood. Okay, now, when we first came up with this, now I'm basically a likelihood guy. I think the likelihood function is the most useful thing in statistics. Okay, and I said, well, okay, we've got, you know, programs that can maximize this thing. Let's just go ahead and do it. Okay, one of the guys I have working for me, a guy named Fred Klinker, what he is he's one of the, I call him a Luddite and he doesn't mind, but he says we should use the standard packages and somehow. And so what he did right there was he found a way to basically work this into logistic regression. And so what you do right there is that you basically make a small sample. So that probability right there is going to be approximately the term times the annual probability, the term length. And so when you write down the log likelihood function, okay, by taking the log and making this approximation, you get this expression. And I just translated it over to the next page. The first term in the thing doesn't involve p. So if we're going to try to basically choose the p that maximizes this likelihood, we don't even need to look at the first term. But now what we do is we take a look right here at the expression that comes out of this, and we compare this with the likelihood function that logistic regression takes of. And if you compare the w here, okay, with the sample rate here, okay, you can see, well, gee, if we set the W equal to S in the case when we have a claim, and if we set the W equal to TS when we don't have a claim, logistic regression, standard logistic regression will give you the P's that you estimate from that will be the annual probabilities. Okay, this will go up on a web. You can stare at the math. Okay, but this is one of the nice little tricks that sort of went into this that you will need to know should you want to customize the model. So in summary, what we've done right here is that we have built a model right here that estimates the loss cost as a function of various business, demographic, and weather conditions. Okay. We have demonstrated, you know, through the diagnostics that we have a reasonable model, okay? And what we have done right there is saying, yes, we got lift, and then we say we have reduced 1,000 variables down to 5 that can be used to customize the model. Now, I think what I'll do right there is I'll let this go over directly to you and take questions later because I don't want to...
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Are there...
It's probably a good time for your question.
Okay. Okay, let's go for questions. Are there any questions about this? Yes?
How do you
file? I would say about 200,000 when you take a look at how the geographic thing comes in. Yeah, the question right there was how can we file the model? Okay, essentially what we're going to do right there is basically file, okay, the methodology and the data the kind of data right here that we use to do this. And I'll have to admit, when we're getting into filing, I'm not the best guy to say right here, but we are having a lot of discussions with our filing people. And there's we're having to deal with questions like, okay, suppose we change some of the input, we get new demographic data, do we have to refile? And stuff like that. And those are actively being discussed right now. But we are, what I will say right there is we are putting a lot of effort into the filing effort because we think that will basically make the product more valuable. I mean, we don't have to, but,
Was the number 200,000 per state?
No, countrywide. If you take a look there, it comes out, it's about 200,000 separate rates, So it's not exactly address specific, but it's pretty close. Yeah. Over here? Well, when we compare this to the original territories, I would go back to you saw the maps right here. But say, for example, this graph right here. This is the differences in the relativities. Okay, and the idea right there is, there's definitely a noticeable number right there, that are between 85 and 95 and 105 to 115, and it sort of trails off that. It depends upon the line. But these are different than the territories, and then if you go to the map itself, you can see that the territories definitely are carved up. So, there is real impact, and again, right there, these do track with losses. That's what the LIFT calculations show. What you could do right here is that the way it could be used, people could, or a company could, if they wanted to, take this thing and substitute it. Wherever we have a territory base rate, substitute the output of this model. That is one way to do it. Yeah, we had, about 25 million car years of data. Okay. We actually had a debate about that right there. And it turned out that, we actually did some comparisons with simulation-type data using a Poisson model. And this, we thought, was easier to implement. A lot of times when you're looking at individual company data, quite often, you have to go through and count up claims. And we thought this was much cleaner. And this will get almost exactly the same result had we gone through a Poisson-type model, which was the alternative we considered. Yeah. Well, we only did the principal components on the numeric variables. The weather variables, what the kind of data we looked at was, say, for example, number of days of the year on average below freezing. They were all numeric variables. What we did right there is that we treated the output of the model, which will be the base loss cost, and then we actually calculated the premium. okay, that would result from using those as loss costs. That includes, we use the vehicle factors, we used the driver factors, including multi-car discounts and all those things. We used all that stuff in calculating the loss ratios. And the differences in those bars were differences in loss ratios. Okay? So that's the way that, you know, we take into account all the other variables. We use, you know, what is being used currently. Mike? It's what we consider it to be a separate product. I mean, we are still going to support the territories, but this is an addition to it. Well, what we do right there is that in the fitting of the model itself, okay, we actually include not only, you know, the variables that went into it that were territory specific. In other words, we know, okay, we have a record. We know what kind of driver's assigned to it. We know the vehicle. We know the multi-car discount. We know all that stuff. Okay, and we actually, when I put in the description of the model itself. Let's see, we had other classifiers. Okay, so those were actually put into part of the model. And then when we deployed the model, we deployed it to the base class. And that's what got, okay, the loss, the predicted loss costs for the base class. And that's what the output. It took us a while to get there. Yeah, question? Yeah.
Trying to understand this, how this would apply on top of the rate right now, when the GLM model is used.
Yeah.
We'll be out of here by 5:30. I guarantee that. I will stop mid-sentence. We're out of here at 5:25. So don't worry about that. I want to discuss another kind of loose topic with regards to that we want to talk about as it applies, that pertains to auto insurance, is this notion of household averaging. I want to get into what does it mean. How do we define household averaging? What is it trying to solve, if anything? What are the issues associated with the data, and what are some implementation issues associated with this idea of household averaging? Basically, at the end of the day, we all know that we have policies, and policies have vehicles, and policies have operators. And effectively, we assign, I mean, traditionally and historically, we've assigned an operator to a vehicle. Why have we done this? We've done this because we like the car year. Why do we like the car year? I don't know. We like the car year for the various reasons that we like exposures. I think there's a nice paper, that old paper on parts. Anyways, but we use the car year as a stable exposure base, and that's why we assign an operator to a car year. And effectively, the way that we've tend to assign it is we've either used some type of agent or insured rule, some type of the agent's doing the assignment. The agent says, this is the driver of that car. The insured is telling the agent, I'm the principal driver of that car. Assign me accordingly. Alternatively, we've done variants of the highest rated operator to highest rated vehicle with various rules. And I think every company has their own set of rules of why they assign different operators to different vehicles. But at the end of the day, we have one vehicle, we have one operator assigned to one vehicle on the policy. More recently, though, we're seeing a lot more companies using driver averaging to try to reflect the fact that we have more operators on the policies or less operators on the policies than vehicles. And to also try to reflect the fact that, you know, some operators don't always drive the vehicle that they're assigned to. there's a relationship between vehicles and operators that we want to reflect. So this notion of household averaging is trying to solve this problem. Effectively, when you look at a standard rating algorithm for driver averaging, you know, factors are gathered for each operator on the policy. So if I have two vehicles and three operators, I'm going to gather a series of factors for those operators, average them out, and then apply that average. And we'll talk about different ways to average. But I take these three operators, average them out, and that becomes my class factor to apply to my driver factors. Fair enough, and we'll talk about a variety of different averaging techniques that are available, but first, let's give a very simple example of three vehicles and three operators, mom, dad, and junior. In traditional sense, let's say that we are just using an assignment, the standard actual assignment, where dad is the primary driver on vehicle one, mom is primary on V2, and junior drives V3. So effectively, again, you know, we can all multiply things together. We have a vehicle rate times an operator rate, and that becomes our policy rate. And when the drivers don't, this is a simple case where the drivers equal the vehicles. When the number of drivers don't equal the vehicles, we apply different rules. If it's greater than, you know, you do like the highest rated drivers are assigned first. If there are less drivers than vehicles, then there's additional rules assigned for that excess vehicle coverage, and there's different considerations associated with this. We tend to see this with preferred riders in most historical companies. This is kind of the foundation, if you will, of standard assignment rules. Whether or not, again, variants do exist, but at the end of the day, they all have this type of flavor. The idea behind highest to highest is where, well, we have three vehicles. Let's assign the highest rated driver to the highest rated vehicle and calculate a rate accordingly. The advantage of this using this highest to highest is that we don't have to rely on someone like the insured maybe misleading us or whatever you want to say. We don't have to rely on the fact that we could be receiving misleading information. So we have an automatic procedure to do some type of highest to highest assignment. Again, when drivers don't equal vehicles, you see the same type of rules in place. This tends to be more used by non-standard insurers. So let's first talk about straight driver averaging, I would ignore the actual policy comparison numbers, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but what we're effectively doing is we have an operator factor associated with each driver, and I'm going to take the straight average of those things, and then that becomes my driver factor, and I apply that straight average to the individual vehicle driver, to the individual vehicles. So here, we don't really care who's principally operating the vehicle. And what you could argue is saying, well, you know, even though dad is the principal driver of vehicle one, occasionally mom drives it, occasionally junior drives it. And so in that sense, we want to reflect that. By doing a straight average approach, we're kind of saying, and there's issues with this, but we're kind of saying that they're all driving vehicle one equally. We might not like that, but that's an approach that's been talked about with regards to straight averaging. Some people don't like that assignment type principle, that equal weighting type principle, and they do some type of percentage weight. You know, dad primarily drives vehicle one, but occasionally drives vehicle two. Mom primarily drives V2, but occasionally drives vehicle one, and junior is not allowed to drive mom or dad's car. And so a weighted average is calculated. The big question is, you guys are, and we'll talk about this in the data scheme, in the data section, is the big question is, you know, how do I get those numbers on the left-hand side there, or on the right-hand side? No, that's right, the right-hand side. How do I get those numbers on the right-hand side? And there's issues with sides associated with that. But effectively, we are trying to create some type of averaging, reflect some type of the fact that some drivers or that operators on the policy will drive vehicles on the policies. I mean, because again, mom will occasionally drive vehicle one. How do we reflect that within an assignment? How do we want to reflect that? In this weighted averaging approach, as you can imagine, the determination of the weight is key to the calculation. So, you know, some insureds actually believe which is fine. We shouldn't be that negative, but some insureds take the word of their insurers take the word of their insureds and allow the insureds or the agent to populate those fields. Other insureds create a principal and occasional structure where the only question that the agent has to ask is, dad, which car are you principal on? And by default, mom and junior are occasional on that car. And for the excess vehicle, everybody is occasional on that car. So there's, you know, there's different weighting structures applied. And we'll talk about how we solve for those different the weights accordingly. I want to quickly talk about modified averaging. This generally, we've seen modified averaging where the driver, there's more drivers than vehicles. And so in order to, this is a little bit different from the primary, but here we have more drivers than vehicles. And in modified averaging, we've seen taking the highest two operators and averaging those out to come up to my driver factor. It's a variant of the same theme, but it's something that we've seen companies use. And again, we're still not concerned about who's principally operating the vehicle. We're just saying, I've got two vehicles, three operators. Let's take the highest two operators, and we'll average that. That's just been out there. And then there's a hybrid approach that says, well, do straight averaging or do some type of weighted averaging for everybody except for youthfuls. Except for youthfuls. So for in that case, my two vehicles, vehicle one and vehicle two, I've got mom and dad's car, and they're going to be averaged. But on vehicle three, since that's junior's car, he's going to apply directly to that vehicle three. So we've seen that. Again, variant of the same three. We'll call this an assignment approach. Driver assignment, and this is a hybrid approach because there's some element of driver assignment. Specifically, junior is driving vehicle three. Ultimately, why do companies do this? First, one of the primary goals is trying to eliminate issues about manipulation. It's worried, the company is worried that insurers are going to manipulate the fact that if I can change the way that I can say that who's being assigned to the operator, insurers or agents, and if I change that, I can manipulate the rate. It streamlines the application process because you don't have to avoid, depending on how you do it, but you don't have to get into too much detail about the assignment questions. Some of the difficult questions it gets rid of some difficult questions. Specifically, in the highest rated operator situation, the question we've always heard is, why is Junior being rated on the expensive car he never drives? So it gets rid of questions like that. Or why do similar vehicles have very different rates because of the assignment of the class factor? So those are just traditional type of questions it does get rid of. We will talk about new questions it raises, though. Interestingly enough, we actually have a much more straightforward algorithm, and we'll talk more about that, with regards to driver averaging. To the extent now that throughout the 90s, we incorporated a ton of different information about our policy into our rating algorithm, specifically things like the number of youthfuls on the policy, the number of accidents on the policies, the number of convictions at the policy level. And the whole goal behind this, in addition to segmentation, the whole goal behind adding all these neat and additional variables is the idea that some operators are going to drive vehicles that they aren't assigned to. So by directly or explicitly reflecting the assignment in the underlying data, or actually reflecting the explicitly assignment in the rating algorithm, all those variables about number of operators, total number of accidents, total number of convictions, lose a lot of weight, lose a lot of predictive, lose a lot of luster, I guess. To that end, model interpretation is easier. For example, traditionally, this is a data set where the x-axis represents driver age, and this is, I think, this is the male curve. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's a standard driver age curve where you see a backward J-shaped pattern. High youthful rates, then it kind of tapers off, and then you get the senior rates start to increase. The mature market starts to increase. But what we've often seen in these J-shaped patterns is this bump. And this bump in an assignment world tends to occur because this is when people have kids. This is when the assignment rules start to take over. And so that bump occurs. And what has happened is if you incorporate number of youthfuls in your model, that bump disappears. So the idea behind driver averaging is, well, instead of incorporating a dimension called number of youthfuls, let's create a data set. Let's actually create a cross-dimensional schema of each combination of driver and operator. Are there concerns? Oh, yeah. There are manual rule changes that need to happen. The quoting process needs to happen. So all these implementation concerns that we're really used to talking about. We now have other questions to answer. So we've We no longer have to answer those. We don't have those other different. We've answered some difficult questions, but new questions have arisen. Specifically, when you do driver averaging, why does every vehicle's premium change when junior was added? Now, that's a question you have to wrestle with. Well, how do I deal with that? And then how do I quantify the impact of adding junior to the policy? Because by changing the average class factor, which applies to each individual vehicle, all of a sudden each individual vehicle's changed, and it's not a simple just, I'm adding junior and he only